This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we talk with perhaps the world's foremost expert on robotics and artificial intelligence about everything from the future of driverless cars to the ethics of the development of autonomous weapon systems. So now, let's go inside the Compass. With his loosely trimmed white beard and his wild hair barely tamed in a bushy ponytail, Professor Emeritus Noel Sharkey still looks very much like the hippie apprentice tradesman and prankster he says he was in his youth in Ireland, before he settled down at about age 30 and went to university to study psychology. But from those unlikely roots, Sharkey rose to become perhaps the world's most respected authority on robotics, one whose opinions on the potential and ethics of the use of robots are now sought out not only by journalists, but also by military and political leaders around the world. Best known for his contributions to cognitive science and artificial intelligence, Sharkey was until his recent retirement the chair of the Department of Computer Science at the University of Sheffield in England, although he's probably much better known as the host of several wildly popular television programs in the United Kingdom about robots and artificial intelligence, including Robot Wars, Techno Games, and Bright Sparks. He's also the founder and editor-in-chief of the academic journal Connection Science, and an editor for Artificial Intelligence Review, as well as for Robotics and Autonomous Systems. Sharkey was recently vacationing in Port Townsend, and favored KPTZ Compass with an interview. Your training was in psychology. So how does a psychologist become the go-to person for robotics?
I'm one of those people who has a very short boredom threshold. And so when I work in a subject for a certain length of time, I feel I have to move on. And when I was young, I liked hard things. And I love psychology. I'm still very interested in how the mind works. And one of the reasons why I got into robotics was because I was trying to discover how the mind works. I tried everything. But I moved from psychology in my PhD to artificial intelligence. And then I thought that artificial intelligence was sort of vacuous because it wasn't connected to the world. I was working in language understanding. How on earth do you make a machine understand language that isn't connected to the world? So I wanted to connect it to the world through robotics. And as soon as I got into robotics, I forgot all about the language understanding. I got so caught up in the robotics that that's what I became a roboticist and worked on that. But my main field within artificial intelligence was machine learning, and so I just transferred that to self-learning robots.
I actually knew you back at the point where you were making that transition, and at first you were quite the critic, and I think you remain quite the critic, of the very notion of artificial intelligence and would really question the possibility of that. But it's decades later now. So what do you think? Are we getting anywhere close to anything that might really be called intelligence?
In some ways, but it's different than what we might have thought. When in 1982, I was an extreme enthusiast for artificial intelligence and believed everything I read. I was living in the UK, but I had the opportunity then to work at the Yale Artificial Intelligence Laboratories and try the best artificial intelligence that was available in the world. And I went through a period of depression because it wasn't what I was cracked up to be. And what artificial intelligence is brilliant at is hype and false predictions. I think it's most famous for false predictions than anything else. We're going to have all our household chores carried out for us by robots by 1975. And it's not too far out. I mean, now we are in 2014 and I've got a little robot vacuum cleaner. It's rubbish as a vacuum cleaner, but it's quite a good robot. So that's as far as we've got. And we've got robots now that can fold a towel for you, but it takes it 25 minutes. So it's slightly disillusioning. But in terms of intelligence, it depends on what you mean. We've got machines. We've beaten the world chess champion. I mean, that's a wonderful achievement to do. But it was done by brute force. I mean, the founders of artificial intelligence actually believed you're going to program machines to be intelligent. And what happens with the chess playing is that it can search millions upon millions of moves a second. So it beats a human by brute force by being able to search right to the end of the game and look for what is a winning move. And that's how it works. So you get masses of processors and things. And you've also got a machine now that's beat humans at Jeopardy, the best human at Jeopardy. That's an incredible achievement. But these are all closed games. They're all language games. But when you get out into the real world, the chess-playing robot didn't care if it won or not. It's no interest in the game. There's no motivation there. If I'd taken away its opponent and all the chess pieces, it would have carried on playing regardless and not cared whether it won or not. When it beat Kasparov, it didn't go, hey, I've won. It just, you know, program terminated.
And so in terms of training a machine to have what humans would just think is the most sort of common sense judgment has eluded the scientists so far.
Yes, I mean, what it's very good at doing, anything that requires very high-speed search, anything that requires dull, dirty, dangerous, repetitive tasks, that's what you use a machine for. If you want to, a machine, if you want to do deliberative reasoning, thoughtful, deliberative reasoning, the best machine for that is a human, without question, on the planet. And I think for the foreseeable future, I mean, artificial intelligence, or AI, has sort of wrong-footed science in many ways, because in normal scientific endeavour, it's up to you as a scientist to prove your ideas, or at least find confirming instances of your hypothesis. And what AI has done is say, if I would argue against it, they would say, well, you can't prove to me in principle that this can never be done. And that's a ridiculous thing to say. And I have to remind them about Sir Isaac Newton, who said, when he was talking about the scientific method to religious people, he said, you can argue all day with me that there are cups and saucers rotating around the sun, and I can't prove that that is false. But that's not my job. It's up to you to prove that it's true. And that's where AI's gone wrong. So it's up to me to prove that never in the future, right into a million years' time, it will never be intelligent. And I can't do that as a scientist. But I would like to see some evidence that it's possible. And I have seen none, but I've only been working in it for 40 years, so, you know, who am I to judge?
But machines increasingly now are being asked to make judgments. And one of the best examples of that is the driverless car. I mean, like the idea that we will very soon, well, in fact, already have driverless cars. Yeah. Google's been working on that, and I hear that those have been quite successful, right? But that's an area in which the vehicle would be expected to make some pretty important snap judgments. So, I mean, what do you think about the driverless car and its future?
Well, let me say to start with, I love the driverless car. As a roboticist, I think it's the most incredible achievement I've seen. Google have put a lot of money into it, but it all grew out of military use. The DARPA grant challenge, so they had a challenge across the Mojave Desert where a car had to drive across the Mojave Desert without a driver, 140 miles. The first year it was rubbish, the second year they got better, and out of that grew the Google car. But it's not, I mean, we have to be very careful. I think it has a great future. I think it's coming. I think we'll see them on our roads. But I think that there's going to have to be a lot of changes on the highways, for instance. Google are claiming that they will save lives, save a lot of road deaths. But Google are being very, very careful because, of course, if one person is killed now by a machine, even though that might be only one person, these things will be cast aside forever. People will not tolerate a machine killing them. If they've been around for 20 years and had not killed anyone, then killed one person and had saved thousands of lives on the road, that'd be a different matter. But the one thing about Google saying that it will save lives, and it's a meme, as it were. Everybody keeps saying it. When I go to conferences, people say, well, of course, the driverless car is going to save lives. Well, there's one thing absent from this, and that is any evidence whatsoever that Google's cars will save lives. I'm inclined to believe it, but there's no evidence for it. We don't know until we put it on the roads. And it might be too late by then, because if you imagine what we know about cars now and the number of millions of people that have been killed in car accidents, if we had known that way back in the 1910s or 1920s, we would not have cars today. We wouldn't have gone for it.
You think we would have been scared off by...
Yeah, we would have been scared off. But of course, by the time road deaths started piling up, it was too late. We were invested heavily in it. But I have great hopes for the Google car, because what you could imagine for the future is that the highways will change so that they would have to all be driverless cars, really, to be safe. You couldn't mix driverless and non-driverless in a real safe way. So I think...
Well, I mean, they're doing that already, though. I mean, the tests have been of driverless cars on the highways with drivers.
It's a driverless car, not driverless cars, not lots of them, and going very, very slowly as well. If you want to go for the future where people are using them all the time, you could imagine that they would go really fast. I mean, the big advantages of driverless cars can't be seen in a normal highway, because the big advantage could be cars roaring down the highway really quickly and really safely in long chains. So you could imagine that you come onto a freeway. It wouldn't be all over the place. You could drive onto the freeway and you have sensors on the freeway, you have cameras on the freeway. The freeway can communicate with your car. Your cars can all communicate with each other. You drive up to the freeway, a space will be left for you between cars. You get in and you're hammering along in a good chain of cars. But it also puzzles me a little bit, because we already have this technology. It's called trains. And, you know, in some ways, though I really respect the Google driverless car, in some ways I'd rather see trains being used more and more public transport, which would be for everyone rather than this really expensive technology. And we'd certainly save road deaths if we had trains everywhere.
Now, another area in which I know that there's hope that these machines are going to be able to make decisions for themselves and think quickly and act is in the military. DARPA was involved in the driverless car for a reason. And I know that you've become one of the world's like prominent critics of drones. But there's a new generation of weapons being contemplated. And I wonder if you can tell me a little bit about what kinds of weapons are on the drawing boards and what you think of that.
Well, there have been a lot of robotic weapons in use. A drone is a robotic weapon, but it's remotely controlled. So someone is sitting at two people are sitting at a big screen, one driving the plane. You could call it flying if you want. They've got a joystick, another one working the sensors so you can fire a Hellfire missile. And they've got great big screens in front of them, so they're looking at the target. And they're not managing it terribly well. A lot of collateral damage. The CIA are using it, and it always strikes me, who in their right mind would let the CIA have an air force of its own of drones? I mean, people must be insane. If you come from the generation that I come from and remember the assassinations, the bungled messes that the CIA left us with, it's completely crazy. But putting that aside, the new idea is not to have those guys sitting there at big screens guiding them, but for the robots themselves to fly out and make their own kill decisions. Now, they're called autonomous weapons, and an autonomous weapon, according to the Department of Defense, U.S. Department of Defense, is a weapon that, once activated, will select targets and engage them with lethal force without further human intervention. So this thing can be sent off either on the ground, and don't think of Terminator robots, that's a big mistake. Think of an automated tank, think of an automatic jet plane, think of a boat, a ship with guns on it. Those are the kinds of things, and they're being developed, and people didn't really know about them. They were in your military plans on the internet, but people weren't looking at them particularly, and I discovered so many of them in 2007, and it derailed my career, because I was so shocked and horrified by the lack of knowledge of the people who were proposing these, who had no idea of the limitations. They just saw these are great weapons we can go out and kill people with, you know, and we won't put any of our own soldiers at risk. But the problem was, they can't discriminate between a civilian and a soldier, a civilian and any other target, or a wounded soldier, or a soldier who's mentally ill.
Can they distinguish between a civilian and a cow?
Possibly in very good lighting conditions in a laboratory, using facial recognition software. But we're talking about out here in the field in warfare. I mean, vision is very bad. There's something called automatic target recognition, and billions of dollars have gone into this over a period of 40 years. And what they can do now is it can recognize a tank, providing it's in the desert, away from anything else, in uncluttered environments. And they keep putting out calls to us academics asking us to help, because the systems are not very good. They could recognize a ship at sea, providing it's, you know, not surrounded by other ships. And they have to do that because ships are moving targets. So if you fire a missile at a ship, it has to reacquire the target when it gets there. But if it was a clutter environment, that would be impossible. But more seriously is that they can't reason like we can, so it's not always appropriate to kill people, even if it's legal. Many military commanders tell me, you know, there was instances where the targets were completely legal, but they decided not to kill them. And in instances, a group of American Marines, U.S. Marines, had trapped a group of insurgents in an alleyway in Iraq. They noticed they were carrying a coffin. So they took off their helmets and lowered their machine guns and let them pass out of respect. But they were perfectly legitimate targets. So a robot would have just gunned them all down. Of course, it would be just programmed to do that, because you could obviously program a robot not to shoot anybody with carrying a coffin. And then you'd find that every insurgent in Iraq was carrying a little mini coffin on the shoulder so that nobody would shoot them. But there's an infinite number of circumstances that can occur in warfare where it's inappropriate. And the sort of horror stories that I used to wake up in the night thinking about way back in 2007 was a child running out with a stick in its hand and the mother screaming, you know, come back, what are you doing? And a soldier would see this situation, the mother screaming and the child running with the stick. A robot would just see a woman screaming and somebody with a gun and kill them. So those are the kinds of worries that I really had. And another big worry in the laws of war is that really you have to make proportionality decisions, and I don't like them. And the idea is that you can kill civilians providing it's of direct military advantage. Nobody knows what direct military advantage is. There's no metric for this. There's no way to objectify it. And so a commander has to make that human judgment. And if they get it wrong, they're culpable. They're responsible for it. A robot is not responsible if it gets it wrong. So those are the kinds of things. But on top of all that, a number of my colleagues, and I agree with them, say that moral philosophers who say it is just wrong for machines to make decisions about killing humans. We're crossing a fundamental moral line here. A machine should not decide whether I live or die. That should be something a human should do.
Now, when you say this discovery derailed your career, I mean, what would you mean by that?
Well, I found that the first thing I did was I wrote a newspaper article for The Guardian, our national newspaper, and then I got lots of invites from the military to come and talk to them and explain to them about these weapons, because they didn't know about them particularly and how they worked. And so
they were asking you to come in and talk about the function. You were basically being consulted as an ethicist.
And the limitations of the technology, how it worked and what was wrong with it and why it was fantasy, and just generally getting discussion together. And then in 2009, myself and a small group of academics, four of us, met at my house in Sheffield in the UK, one from the United States, one from Australia, one from Germany, and myself. And we founded an organization called the International Committee for Robot Arms Control, where we were calling for international discussion. United States, Britain, Israel, Russia and China were all developing these weapons, as I found out from various journalists I'd spoken to, and yet they weren't talking about it to each other. Other small countries didn't even know about the existence. So we thought it needs international discussion, because they were talking about the big term being used by everybody was swarms. So you've a swarm of robotic jets going, not one. A swarm. And the idea that one swarm would meet another swarm and have not unknown programs on board, so that when they interacted with each other, you couldn't possibly predict how they would interact. And these guys weren't discussing together. So our mission was to get international discussion going about the prohibition or regulation of these weapons. And that was in 2009. And most people there were philosophers who were discussing these issues. And they could be lied to or deceived by manufacturers. And then I have technical knowledge and it's not so easy to deceive me. I could really go for them. So I get kind of trapped in this and felt responsible now to do it. And so I actually ended up stopping doing robotics and just going into general questions about the military and really researching it. And I spent my whole life now just traveling around giving talks. But last year, we actually started Human Rights Watch, a very famous organization, the Nobel Women's Initiative, and some other NGOs, big, powerful NGOs, got together with me and said, let's start a campaign to get these things prohibited. And we had always just wanted at least international discussion. But these big NGOs got together and we grew to be 50 of us, including Amnesty International, Oxfam, all these great big organisations. And they really put pressure on people. And so the UN began to talk about it. The Special Rapporteur for Extrajudicial Killings wrote a report calling for an immediate pause until we could discuss it in a moratorium. And then we took it to a committee called the CCW. And that's a committee that bans things like poisonous gases, blinding lasers, all the kinds of weapons that get banned. They have five protocols that ban weapons, and we'd like this to be protocol number six. Now, 3 or 4 years ago, people said to me, oh, they won't even be interested, they'll never talk about it. But with this powerful group, suddenly it got onto it. We got it onto the agenda. We needed 170 nations to agree to not veto it, to get it onto the agenda of the CCW for an expert discussion. We got it onto the agenda last November, which was just amazing, with the campaign only 6 months old. Landmines, it took them 5 years even to look at it. And it was because when it came out at the UN, a lot of countries were saying, what? You're doing what? They hadn't even heard about this stuff. They were shocked. And so we had the big expert meeting in May this year, and 270 delegations appeared there from different countries. Lots of countries have spoken up. Five countries have already asked for a total ban, but they're only, well, not little, but not high-tech countries. We get Pakistan, Ecuador, the Holy See, which is the Vatican City, of course, and I can't remember who the other two were. But there were low-tech countries who were just saying, you're just trying to find more and more ways to kill us. And the CCW doesn't belong to the UN, but that's where it meets.
Oh, so what's CCW stand for again?
Certain Conventional Weapons, but it's a really long title, this Committee of the Convention of Certain Conventional Weapons that cause undue harm or suffering to humanity. So that's what it's about. And we would say these would cause undue harm and suffering to humanity. And the United States Department of Defense and their delegation to the UN actually helped us get this through the CCW. They're keen to have international discussion, which was surprising to me because they were leading the way in the technology. But they want to know, is this actually workable? Is it going to be harmful? So that's really quite interesting to me. But I'm Irish as well, and the Irish are really behind us, of course, too. But they're a very peaceful nation. But the main thing for us is we succeeded in our mission now. We've had to change our mission statement because we've got international discussion. We have all the nations know about it now. But the trouble with the CCW is that it's about international humanitarian law. That's the laws of war. So if we get a legally binding instrument there, like Protocol Number 6 of the CCW, to totally ban these autonomous weapons, it would only be banning them in warfare. It would not stop your police from using them. It would not stop border control agencies from using them. It would not stop internal conflict, like Syria. It wouldn't stop that kind of use. It would only be about international conflict only. It's the same with tear gas. Tear gas is banned internationally, but yet police can use it.
In the United States, that would be an extrajudicial killing, so i.e. a murder if no trial had taken place. So it's hard for me to actually imagine a police force using those sorts of weapons.
No, well, I mean, your police are already using robots that they remote control. And I think they would be perfectly legitimate under your laws for them to use a robot that was armed under remote control by a policeman who said, halt or I'll make the robot fire at you. And they don't halt and they shoot them down. But we want a ban that's a ban under all circumstances, not just under the laws of war. But the CCW can't give us that, so we also have to go to the UN Human Rights Council as well and get that. Because we're not just talking about the United States, we're talking about any tin pot dictatorship or whatever. I mean, already I found this year, and it's remote control, but in South Africa now, I've just discovered this company called Desert Storm that sell the Skunk Robot. And the Skunk Robot is a quadcopter, you know, a little helicopter drone. And it's been sold to 25 mining companies. And it fires pepper spray and plastic balls. at people, and the idea is to disrupt strikes from miners. So public protest. And you can think about this, oh, we'd never do this in the US. It comes in slowly, step by step. I mean, there's a company in Texas that's made the Cupid robot, which fires tasers at people, and it can be in automatic mode. Now, the idea is you'd put it in your property, and if somebody comes into your property, it would tell them to get out. And if they didn't, it would fire tasers at them and keep electrocuting them until the authorities arrive, which it would call. But it wouldn't be doing anything like doing medical tests on their heart to see if they could stand a shock or not. I mean, you know, 381 people were killed with tasers in the United States by your police force, according to Amnesty International reports. And so you could say that, you know, we're going to arm these autonomous robots not with lethal weapons, but with non-lethal weapons like tasers. But there's no such a thing as a non-lethal weapon. They can all cause harm. Pepper spray can cause suffering. And what you get is a slow mission creep, a creeping authoritarianism. So your police won't use them now because there'll be too many protesters. But eventually you've got these to suppress the protesters who might protest against them. And it comes in, it's so stealthy. It's like CCTV cameras we're getting now. And then we're going to get surveillance drones, which we have all over the UK already used by our police. And they're going to be used in the United States. I know, I've seen discussions and plans about it. And then you arm them because it's going to be a bit difficult to catch people. And all you need is one really high profile case, like a homicidal cop killer on the run, and use this drone. Oh, we did it with that, so that makes it acceptable to the public, and so on and so on. And the unfortunate thing about living in a democracy, and I'm a Democrat myself, but the unfortunate thing about living in a democracy is you change government every 4 or 5 years. Now, you imagine that this technology becomes, you've got a great government who say, oh, we're only going to use it for this and this and this. The next government inherits it, and then all bets are off. They use it for something more. As I said to The Guardian in 2007, when the police were using these, I don't want to be out drinking one night and go up an alleyway for a pee and find myself being tasered for it from the sky and possibly killed with a heart attack. And that's the kind of future I'm looking at. And we're not going to have this future because me and all the campaigners, there are hundreds of us now working hard on this, we're going to stop it.
With robotics professor emeritus Noel Sharkey, this is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. KPTZ Compass is dedicated to going into the community to bring the stories from the community to the attention of the rest of the community. If you're a community-minded person and consider yourself something of a storyteller besides, perhaps you'd like to join us. We stand ready to train promising people in the subtle arts of radio journalism. If you think this might be the right kind of creative work for you, please stop by the station at the Mountain View Commons and talk to us and fill out a volunteer application. And remember, if you have a news tip or story of any kind, send an email to news@kptz.org. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans. Thank you.